Welcome to our Kitchen Table Talks, a podcast of the Public Engagement Initiative, Suffrage, Race, Power, Black Women Unerased.
Unerased, unerased, lift up Black women today. 100 years. Of pain, suffrage, and sorrow, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. It's time to honor those erased from her story. It's time to rise and take our place. In this moment, we won't be erased. Time to rise, time to rise, stand in our power today.
I'm Gwen McKinney, creator of the SRP Unerased Initiative. Our theme song, A Black Woman's Love Song, features Latasha Brown on vocals and Glenn Pearson on piano. And with our podcast host, Washington and former publisher Denise Rollark Barnes, notable activists and thought leaders will share fascinating insights about Black women's engagement during this year's centennial of women's voting rights.
Black women have been ready for a woman president since at least 2016. So when we look at the turnout of Black women, but also Black women's vote choice in 2016, Black women are clearly ready to have a woman president.
Imagine the president not being white, male, and old. You also have seen, I call it coded language, around electability and likability. Words that you don't hear from male counterparts who are running for office and frankly running for president.
Voters are looking for the kind of political leadership that women bring to our politics. And that is courageous, it is thoughtful, it is compassionate, it is considerate in terms of the needs of our communities, of our families, and of our nation.
Black women are the building blocks to a winning coalition. We are absolutely stepping into our power at the voting booth.
Black women overperform in terms of voter participation, so the most likely voter is in fact a Black woman.
We don't go to the polls alone. We bring our house, our block, our church, our sorority, and our union. And then frankly, in 2020, we are demanding our return on our voting investment.
I think the Black women understand that there is power in our community and are prepared to organize that power.
Advances have come for us through the electoral process, through governmental legal processes. So we're invested in that system in a way that perhaps other communities are not.
We cannot continue as a community and as a country to bear the brunt of the kinds of discriminatory and racist policies that prevent both us and our children from being able to live our full potential.
You know, we have to work like hell to make sure that there are no razor-thin margins of victory. 73% of Black women are registered to vote. And we know we vote at high levels, but that also means 27% of Black women are not registered to vote. So that's a healthy margin of people that we can still get registered. And if you're voting at 100% of capacity, then there's no amount of voter suppression that can stand in the way of a victory.
Every time a woman stands up, regardless of her race or ethnicity, and walks into her own power and her own leadership, it creates the space for us to move toward a woman sitting in the Oval Office. I'm Adrienne Shropshire, and I'm the executive director of Black PAC.
My name is Leah Daughtry. I am a political strategist, an author, and a faith leader.
I'm Glenda C. Carr, president and CEO of Higher Heights for America.
Thank you, Glenda, Leah, and Adrienne. I'm Denise Rollark Barnes, publisher of The Washington Informer. Up next, a conversation at our virtual kitchen table. I'm thrilled to welcome Donna Edwards, a political analyst and former member of Congress, the first Black congresswoman from Maryland. And we have Kelly Dittmar, a scholar with the Eagleton Center on Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Sisters, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Denise.
Yeah, great to be here.
Thank you so much. You know, we're doing our project called Suffrage, Race, Power, which approaches August centennial of women's voting rights by redefining the narrative of a movement that often marginalized or erased the role of Black women. So as we look back at the past and towards a major election in November, I'd like each of you to sort of define for me what Black women unerased means to you, especially based upon your knowledge and experiences. Kelly, can I start with you?
Sure. I think that as somebody who teaches students about women's political history, part of being sure that we think about Black women as unerased means telling the full story of women's political history. And too often that story has been centered and focused on white women's experiences and input, efforts, and activism, when we know that in many cases it was Black women leading the way, whether it be in suffrage, whether it be in the civil rights movement, which then led to a lot of the activism around the second wave of the women's rights movement, and so on, even to current day. And so I think the unerased portion is really rewriting and re-envisioning the stories and narratives we tell to be sure that we're not leaving out important actors, important groups of individuals who made our current reality what it is.
Donna, you want to weigh in?
Well, you know, Kelly, it's interesting that you raise these points in history where, of course, Black women have always been a part of the great movements that have brought the country where we are now. And I think of my own personal experience, I can almost not think about a single work experience over my entire career, whether that was in the public sector, in the private sector, and of course, through my tenure in Congress, where I was not either the only or very few number of Black women in those spaces. And I think for me, the celebration and commemoration of 100 years of women being able to vote is always with a few mixed emotions, because after all, for Black women, that didn't hold true for the better part of the 20th century. And Congress has only ever had about 47, fewer than 50 Black women who've ever served in Congress in our history. And most of them in the latter part of the 20th century and into the 21st century. And when you think about that, the important levers of power in the country and only ever held by a handful. And so on the one hand, it tells us how much we've achieved, but on the other hand, it really is a demonstration of how far we have to go.
Ladies, I want to ask too, do we come to politics as women who happen to be Black or Black people who happen to be women? Do we look at this as one priority over the other based upon your experiences?
Wow, what a loaded question. Even my experience, for example, within the Congressional Black Caucus, even in that smaller space in the context of the larger Congress, still very heavily male dominated. It's hard not to think of yourself as a woman and then as a Black woman, because even in our Black spaces, and we've seen this throughout the modern day civil rights movement, that the faces, the work, the voices of Black women have been put on the second shelf, even in our recollection of the movement. And my experience in Congress is that it was always important to think of myself as a Black woman. I don't know that I could separate the two. I remember when I was heading the Bipartisan Women's Caucus, all of the women in the Congress, and then we launched a women's economic agenda. And I insisted that when we talked about equal pay, that we couldn't just say all women were paid 85 cents on the dollar, whatever the 65 cents, whatever the number is now, but that we had to include what that number is for Black women and for Brown women, because otherwise our economic status would not be fully realized in that context.
I would just add to that too, that this is the heart of what Kimberly Crenshaw has discussed as intersectionality, right? In terms of creating a space in which we can understand history, we can understand individual experiences, just as the Congresswoman is talking about, in a way that recognizes and doesn't require women to choose parts of themselves. And one thing that Kimberly Crenshaw has said, as long as feminists like all theorists continue to search for gender and racial essences, Black women will never be anything more than at a crossroads between two kinds of domination or at the bottom of a hierarchy of oppression. We'll always be required to choose pieces of ourselves to present as wholeness. And I use that and try to explain that to my students and to folks when we're thinking about telling our histories, thinking about experiences of individuals, just as the Congresswoman noted, so that it is the job of those of us who are doing the analysis to not ask folks to choose one part of themselves.
Thank you. You know, Higher Heights CEO Glenda Carr, featured in our Just Saying segment, she talks about coded language, words that male office seekers sometimes use pertaining to the electability and likability of women candidates. And I'm wondering if this tactic sounds familiar to either one of you, and what impact has that had on the political power of women? Donna?
Well, as a candidate, it certainly rings familiar with me. I mean, I can recall when I first ran for Congress back in 2006, and I remember the ways in which I was described, words like overly aggressive, tough, hard, all of the kinds of characteristics that for male candidates were considered a plus. You wanted somebody who was going to go in there and be a fighter and not be soft and be willing to stand up. And it was a challenge for me personally. How could I be myself and at the same time soften myself so that I could be appealing? And I think women as candidates wrestle with it all the time. I think particularly for Black women, it is a real challenge. I remembered being described as an angry Black woman, and what I was a fierce fighter. And so it rings very personal for me. And it's not that those things can't be overcome. It's just that they are additional hurdles that can sometimes get in the way of political success.
Kelly, what's been your observation?
I think that language is so spot on, because what we know is that women, and particularly Black women, overcome all of these obstacles in order to be successful. But I always push back and say, what if those obstacles weren't there? How many more Black women would we have in office? Black women would we have willing to run for office? There's a calculation there when you see the landscape and you see the biases that you may very well face as a candidate and an office holder. You may recalculate and decide you're not going to make that decision to run. And so we have to think about the cost of those biases in the first place, whether diminishing candidacy, making it harder to win, even though in spite of those challenges, we've seen success. The Congresswoman was willing to push through those biases, right, in order to be successful. The same is true when it comes to electability. This is a bias we've seen against women for a long time. My colleague Kira Sememmatsu has written about party gatekeepers who have different definitions of electability and perceptions of viability for women candidates versus male candidates. And then when you get more specific to Black women candidates, one of the doubts about electability has been, well, can Black women win in majority white districts? Can they win in statewide electorates? This is why the number of Black women who have been in the U.S. Senate is at 2, and the number of Black women in statewide elected executive office is very small. We've never elected a Black woman governor. And part of this is not because Black women can't win in those spaces. It's that there are gatekeepers who are questioning and doubting the ability to be elected in those spaces. I will say in the most recent election in 2018, we saw more Black women than ever winning in majority white House districts. This is important in pushing back against these concerns and really myths about Black women's electability. And the last piece I'd say to that is that these biases, both likability, but especially in the case of some of our recent elections, electability, really force women candidates to run two campaigns at one time. So not only do you have to prove yourself as the best candidate, you also have to prove to folks that you can be elected. This is something that Stacey Abrams really was contending with, Kamala Harris at the presidential level, Stacey Abrams at the gubernatorial level, to convince donors and voters that yes, members of the public will vote for me. Yes, I can win statewide. In addition to doing the work that your male counterparts are doing, which is to just prove that you have what it takes, you have the best agenda to be that elected official. So that is more work. That is additional hurdles to get to the same result.
Kelly, I wanted to follow up on that a little bit more. Your organization, the Center on Women in Politics, has done outstanding analyses about the voting differences between married white women and single white women as related to Black women married and single. What do you think the most dramatic differences are between these demographic groups?
Yeah, I think even beyond marital status, a lot of our work or our data and analysis, just even looking at differences across racial groups and gender. What we all know, right, and have seen time and again, is that Black women serve as the strongest and most reliable base of the Democratic Party. So they outvote their male counterparts, both Black men and white men, and also white women in the 2008 and 2012 elections, and voted 96% in both of those elections for Barack Obama and at extremely high rates as well for Hillary Clinton in the last election. And so the difference there is that you have an extremely reliable group of voters to the Democratic Party who has often been taken for granted. On the flip side, with white women voters, you have a group that has more diversity in terms of ideological positioning as well as previous presidential vote choice, a lot more diversity in their behavior over time and distinctions by things like marital status. So married white women in particular tending to be more conservative and unmarried women tending to be more liberal. Of course, that overlaps with generation and age. And what we're seeing really as an increased divide among white women especially is levels of education. So college-educated white women over the last few elections, and particularly since 2016, have really shifted to voting pretty consistently Democrat. And non-college-educated white women have actually were increasing their lean towards the Republicans. And the question in 2020 is, does that pattern continue as well? So there's a lot of attention, I think, in analysis on white women, in part because there's always this desire to find the group that's switching the most. When, in my opinion, and in a lot of our analyses, we focus on the point that actually what you really want to know, especially if you're a Democratic candidate, is are you mobilizing Black women to vote because they're going to be your most reliable voters? Looking at engagement and turnout among Black women instead of spending as much time worrying about where those shifting white women voters are going in election. Of course, both are important, but those are often the questions we get and the analyses we do.
Donna, you've had tremendous success in Maryland politics over several years. I mean, you won your congressional seat in 2008 and served until 2017. And as you said earlier, you're the first African-American woman to represent Maryland in the United States Congress. However, in 2016, you were defeated in a statewide senatorial race against a white man. And in 2018, you were defeated in a county election race against a Black woman. When you look back and assessed the voter turnout and the voter favor, how did you do that as it related to gender? Did you see some of what Kelly's talked about, where women landed, what led to either your success or lack of success?
Well, I think that in both elections in 2016 and 2017, I mean, they were very different elections. In the 2016 election, I was running for a statewide office in a state, although where the majority of votes cast in primary elections are actually Black voters, mm-hmm. that I was unsuccessful running against a white male candidate. I think some of that goes to what Kelly was talking about earlier, which is how do voters, Black or white, perceive women in terms of a statewide office like a Senate seat? And I faced a lot of those challenges just trying to justify running for a statewide office, even though I was running with one of my colleagues from the House of Representatives. He was perceived as a senator, whereas I was perceived as a member of the House. And the voter turnout was actually very low that year. And I think that also has to do with what the party does in terms of whether it's really working to mobilize voters to turn out. Sometimes it's actually in the interest of a candidate or another to not have huge voter turnout. So I think some of those things were in effect. Running against a Black woman for a countywide office, I think it was just a different question. I think having done a lot of national politics, I think it was tough for the electorate to perceive me, and we got some of this back from some of our polling, whether the electorate perceived me as somebody who would, in effect, quote, step down to run for a countywide office. But either way, I think Kelly's point is really important, that when your votes are taken for granted, and a lot of times the Black vote and Black women voters are taken for granted, particularly by Democrats, candidates who run for office then are always looking for who are those voters that we can flip. So a lot of the mail and the media and the focus of a campaign goes toward those voters disproportionate to the voters that I'd rather have a voter who votes in an election 90% of the time my way than searching for the voter who might vote for me 40% of the time. And yet it kind of works the reverse, particularly in some of these national elections.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to wrap up, and I thank both of you all for your candid responses. But I'm hoping that both of you all can offer insights on what you think unites women voters of all races and demographic groups, especially as we head into the November general election. Kelly?
I think we are always very careful to say that women and women voters are really diverse and that they are in a monolithic voting bloc. And it's hard, actually, to find things that unite them across race, across party, especially across age and generation. I actually think that's something we should celebrate and value, because we don't assume that men share something across all of those groupings. We allow diversity of opinion and viewpoint and positionality among men, and sometimes we question it and we're concerned that there isn't unity among women. It is not to say that there aren't shared experiences that women have as women. Some of the things that we see come up in our discussions with women, both as candidates and as voters, are particular concerns that are unique to being mothers or daughters because of gender roles in our society and different responsibilities that are placed on women. So there are some commonalities, but I think actually the real value and thing that we should celebrate is the diversity among women and trying to give women that space to disagree as much as they agree.
And Donna?
Yeah, I think that's true. But what I would say is that even if women do not share particular solutions to problems, their shared concerns around healthcare and education and retirement security, even if there are not shared ideas about mm-hmm. solutions to those policy concerns. And I think that when women go to the voting booth in November, they want to cast their vote for a future for themselves and for their children and their families. And they're going to make decisions that they know are in those interests. Look, I'm a partisan, and so I know how I hope it comes out. And I think that that will work to the policy interests that women have post-November.
Ladies, thank you so much, Donna Edwards and Kelly Dittmar, for joining us here at the kitchen table. It's been a pleasure talking to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to close out this table talk with our culture pop segment. Check out this stirring take from the musical The Moment Is Now on Sojourner Truth's famous declaration, I Am a Woman, featuring the vocal stylings of Julia Nixon with lyrics by Jean Bruskin. Enjoy.
I come from another field where the lashing of the slave would never yield. I want slavery destroyed, branch and root, women's rights in every pursuit. Black women, north and south, from every squalor, from every state, and every holler. 'Cause if women ain't free, man can't do better. One half free, the other half is fettered. I am a woman, said I am a woman, I am a woman, yes I am, yes I am. They talk about colored men getting their rights. Not a word about colored women inside. But I have as much muscle as any man. I can work as much as any man. I can eat as much as any man. I can bear the lash as much as any man can. Look at me, people, won't you look at me good? I plow, reap more than I sow, and I chop that wood. But when women get her eyes, day and night, it's gonna be peace on earth and goodwill to men. So I wanna say, wanna say it again. I am a woman. Oh, yes, I
thank you, sister.
This is a moment to tell our story. How we offered our gifts without glory. Through the pain and the fears, the trial and the tears. Despite the veil, we did not fail. Honor us, black women. Honor us.
Thanks so much for listening to Our Kitchen Table Talks, a podcast made possible by support from Craig Newmark Philanthropies, the Groundswell Fund, TD Charitable Foundation, and anonymous donors. Special thanks to vocalist Latasha Brown, pianist Glenn Pearson, producers Sonia Williams, Rosemary Neely, Tarek Ann Gross, Nicole Hayes, and Volubility Podcasting. I'm Gwen McKinney, creator of Suffrage Race Power, Black Women Unerased. I invite you to tune in to our next episode of Our Kitchen Table Talks, And meanwhile, visit us online at srpunerased.com.